Test, test. All right, we're live. Eric Anders Lang Show. Special guest today, Wyndham Clark. Wyndham, PGA Tour player, is that a job or a dream? How do you see it?
Growing up, definitely a dream and still is a dream. But as you start playing a lot more, it starts to become a lot more of a job. The travel can be pretty taxing. The stress, the pressure, all that can be taxing. But at the end of the day, when, you know, I'm teeing a ball up and playing in front of thousands of people and not in a cubicle, it leans more towards the dream.
I mean, I have so many. There we go. I mixed the mics up. All right. I have so many questions about that because I also travel a lot. And, you know, a lot of people, I think, look at my job and they're like, dream job, love to have it, jealous, oh, he's got the life. But in kind of the realer sense of it, it's like exhausting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't really come out there and say that. Like, I'm not like on Instagram being like, I'm so tired, this is such a tough job. But I think a lot of people don't see that. And when you talk about the travel being tough, like, can you explain like what that actually looks like in a week? I mean, it's like you book a flight hours before you go to the airport, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. You've got bags. You've got you're traveling with all sorts of items that people don't normally travel with, I'm assuming. Like,
yep.
Massage things and like,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the travel, it all months in advance, is easy on paper. It's like, all right, we got our hotels, we got our flights, but it doesn't always work out that way. You miss cuts or weather or whatever it is, and so then everything changes. And so typically I get in on a Monday, and Sunday night or Monday, and then we have a practice round and our tournament. But if you miss the cut Friday and we're in the middle of nowhere tournament or you just want to go home, I mean, you change a flight, you fly home, which is even more travel.
Yeah.
And then you're there for a couple of days, and then you go back out to the tournament, or you go to the tournament early, and it's just, it gets taxing. You're flying, on average, probably three flights a week. And, I was a rookie last year, so I was doing 5-6 weeks in a row. And it's just, you're gone for 6 weeks and in hotel rooms. And, it's tough on relationships. It's tough on, your mind and everything. But at the same time, like you said, you don't really want to complain about it because it is very fun to travel. But when you do it 30 plus weeks a year, it's like, man, I just kind of want to be at home and chill.
So I'm assuming I heard the PGA Tour has like a deal with United Airlines. Are you flying commercial or is it like private when you can?
I don't fly private that often unless a buddy sets me up with that.
Who's the buddy that's going to?
Well, just guys on tour. So that's the one nice thing, perk, if you become friends with some guys that have or create relationships with guys on tour that have been out there for a long time. They usually fly private and sometimes like, hey, you want to hop on? And
do you ask or are you like, I'm not going to ask?
It's a little uncomfortable. Yeah, I don't want to be that guy to ask. So the nice thing, Ryan Moore was my rookie year was awesome with me. So I lived in Vegas prior to moving here in Scottsdale. And he, anytime we were in the tournament together and he was flying home, he'd send me a text, hey, if you want a flight home, you can hop on. And he was awesome. He didn't make me pay. And it was definitely a very, luxurious thing.
Oh, because he could easily hit you with a Venmo afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Venmo for a couple thousand. And so as I started, it was funny about that. And I'd give him crap for it, too. As I started playing better and I locked up my car and I made it to the playoffs, he said, hey, after this event, you want to fly home? And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. He goes, yeah, it's going to be about $2,500. And so he hit me with the the Venmo, and I was like, man, I already had a flight for $200 home. I don't know if I can justify spending $2,500. So
because the truth is, like, I mean, I don't know about you, but we were in Korea together.
Yep.
Like that's a long leg, and in some ways, those flights are easier than like two-hour flights.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially if you're going from Florida to, well, I guess Florida, Arizona, you're going to get a direct. But, yeah. A lot of times you don't have a direct option.
Yeah.
Was that a decision? When you decided to move to Arizona, was that part of the decision?
It's actually – so I fly United mainly. Yeah. And
what's your status? It's be 1K, easy.
Yeah, I'm so mad. I missed getting 1K by like 5,000 miles. So I'm platinum.
And you didn't just go for the mileage run? Weren't just like, I'm in.
Well, I wasn't paying attention. And then it happened. And so I'm trying to ask them. I'm like, hey, I've been platinum the last 2 years. Is there any way you can bump me up or something?
Right.
But moving here is worse for United. It's American, Southwest hub. And in Vegas, they actually had United
sure.
kind of mini hub. So it's easier to fly to there. But what's tough is, you know, sometimes the United flight is, you know, it has one or two stops.
Yeah.
And then the Southwest has a direct. So you want to do that. But then, you know, my bag's always overweight.
80 pounds, I have
multiple
sure.
bags. So
how
then,
many bags?
Well, I have two. So I have my golf bag, a really huge travel one.
Yeah.
And I have like a duffel I carry and then a backpack. So,
okay.
You know, I only check two bags, but they're both 70 pounds each, yeah. 65.
Filled with golf shoes.
Everything, yes. And so then I, you know, I get a Southwest flight for whatever, and then it's adding on another 150, 200 bucks, which is, you know, whatever. But it's just after a while, you're like, I don't want to just keep spending this kind of money when,
yeah,
you know.
You're going to play in 28 tournaments this year?
Yeah, probably. 25. Yeah, roughly about that many, yeah.
That's a lot, especially yeah. when it's on both ends of the tournament.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So, but you know, as far as the airlines go, you can do a status match. So you take your status on one airline, you call the other one, and you're like, yo, I'm X on this airline.
Yep.
Will you match? Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I have. So the only problem living here is Southwest doesn't really have that.
They don't care.
They don't really care. So I'm like an A-list guy, but they're like, we don't care. Your bag's still overweight. So,
yeah.
But with American and stuff, I think they do that.
We flew last night L.A. to Phoenix, and 737 Southwest Airlines. We checked in and I was like, yo, can I just pick my seat? And because I don't really fly Southwest that much. And they're like, we don't do that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, okay. And then they were like, but don't worry. There's only 14 people on the flight.
Oh, wow.
144 seats.
You got 14 people. You got one of the lucky flights.
We took off. We took off like 8 seconds after they started the engines. Like the plane was like a paper
That's
airplane.
Incredible.
So the travel stuff is a lot. What else as far as like, you know, getting in, getting grounded. Well, I guess what I wanted to go to was when you talked about sort of teeing it up and in front of people, you know, I am an okay golfer and I do sometimes have this experience of walking down the fairway, outfit is on point,
yeah.
Shoes feel good, glove is brand new, ball is in the middle of the fairway. What do you have a feeling at a tournament or in an event that is the most like sweet for you? You know what I mean? Is it like the draining of a putt? Is it a good chip? Is it a drive?
You know what actually is there's two for me. One, just because growing up, obviously I watched a lot of Tiger. I grew up in the Tiger era, and during his prime, you know, there's some times when he'd miss some fairways and so he'd be off the fairway and they would line up like a little tunnel
sometimes.
Yeah, well, I don't want to rip on Tiger, but they would line up, you know, make a shoot where he's trying to hit. And whenever I get in that situation when there's hundreds of people, you know, lining up something, that's when I'm like, this is cool, because you know I have people right there. And I just, it always brings me back to watching Tiger when, you know, everyone's sitting there, I'm like, man, they could get hit. And then now I'm the guy like, wow, I could hit somebody, you know. So but that's pretty cool. And then the other thing is anytime you make a putt near grandstands or in front of a lot of people and you hear that loud roar or applause, that's when I'm like, man, this is pretty awesome.
You talked about basically the recovery shot.
Yeah.
In golf, is that like part of your coaching? You know, like I spent a lot of time, I don't know if you know Brandon Hagee, he's a local here as well. Yep. And we talked a lot about, he has a acronym that he uses, OTE. Opportunity to excel.
Mm-hmm.
And he really thrived on those as like, oh, I have a chance to be creative and to pull something really interesting off. Is that, what would you say from a mindset standpoint is where does your coaching center around now or your mindset on the golf course?
Well, it's funny. I've always excelled in those recovery shots, mainly just because it like heightens my focus. When I have a regular 150-yard shot to kind of a basic green, you know, it's sometimes I actually hit bad shots because you're just like, I struggle to get focused. But when I have to hit it between a gap that's 3 feet wide, you get hyper-focused. And, on that point, I get really focused on those. But really, any time my caddy always tells me and my coach that, you know, I have a chance to go out and kind of show off. And I love playing in front of crowds. I played other sports growing up. And whenever there was a huge crowd, that was usually one of my best games. When it was kind of a flat gym in basketball and there was just no one there, I kind of played flat. And when there was tons of people and tons of energy, that kind of heightened my play. And so, you know, a week like this, having a lot of people here, you know, it just gets me excited and I'm amped and I'm fun, you know, or it's going to be a lot of fun for me. So,
right. So is that nerves or what is that? You don't sound like you're describing it as being nervous.
It's definitely not nervous. It's more, it's just, I've always, you know, Kobe's one of my favorite athletes and Tiger was one of my favorite athletes, and they always seemed to be in the limelight and they always seemed to perform when there was everyone watching, all the cameras on them. And I think because I aspired to be like them, that when there are the cameras and are the people, I'm like, all right, this is my chance to have a moment like them or to be like them. And so I don't know. It's more just I feel more comfortable when there's a lot of people. I don't know how to explain it.
Right. I think that you don't need to explain it because, you know, your career to date explains it enough. Like getting a tour card alone is like an impossible idea. When you were saying to people that that's what you wanted and you were in, I guess, before college, right? When did you first say, I want a PGA Tour card out loud?
Well, the dream started when I was like 5 or 6.
A little late.
What?
A little late or no?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No. I started when I was 3, but 5 or 6 is when I really thought, all right, you know, I really love this. But in college, after my freshman year, I had a great year and I started having agencies and people talk about, hey, this is what you need to start doing. You're going to be on tour. That's when I was like, all right, I really know I can do this. I always thought I could. But then kind of when I had that affirmation from some people saying, hey, you're going to make it on tour, then I was like, all right. Because, I mean, you obviously, everyone has high expectations for themselves. You know, they think they can always make it. But when you have people that are in the business going, hey, you're going to be there, I was like, all right, I'm going
to
be there.
So even though you got into Oklahoma, that wasn't enough? Even though you got in one of the top-ranked golf schools?
A little bit. I hadn't played against pros. That was the one downside of growing up in Colorado is I never played against guys on the PGA Tour.
Sure.
So I only ever did maybe if I played in some, you know, like a state open and they happened to be there.
But you were the top-ranked amateur.
I was.
Didn't bother you.
Yeah, I still thought I could, but like if I grew up in Arizona and I would have grown up playing against all these guys here and I would beat them, then I'd be like, oh, I'm for sure going to play on tour, but I never got to, so I kind of put them a little bit on a pedestal.
Interesting.
Thinking, okay, man, I really got to get better, which was good for me.
Sure.
It made me think, all right, I got to work harder, I got to get better. But at the same time, my transition for some of my first events, I kind of put all these players on a pedestal.
So, ideal situation on a Sunday. Do you want to be one shot back or one shot clear?
Starting?
First tee time, yeah.
First tee time. Obviously, I'd love to have a one shot lead, but really, if I'm just in the hunt, I think.
Okay.
I mean, the tournament, most tournaments don't really start till the back nine. When you're in contention, if you're within 2 shots, even 3 or 4, I mean, there's crazy things that have happened. So
especially this year so far.
Yeah. I mean, you can make 5 birdies on the back nine or a guy can fall apart. And so as long as I'm within 3 going to the back nine, that's a successful week and that's where I want to be.
So I know you didn't describe it as nervousness, and I'm not sure what that feeling is of being in front of people. I have heard and read doing some research on the mental game that nervousness doesn't equate to bad performance. In fact, for me, I've noticed that it helps. Like, yeah. I hit my best shots when I'm super nervous. Like, you know, wherever it is, where people are watching, where I'm thinking, I got to do this. Like, that's when I actually play the best. I'm curious to know if you have a recollection of the most nerve-wracking shot you had since turning pro.
Oh, yeah. Probably my first tour event was the Travelers. This was 2 years ago. It was on a sponsor exemption. And one of my first tee shots, I kind of blacked out. I mean, I was really nervous, and I knew I would be. But I've played in big amateur events, but never a big PGA event. And there was, I don't know, say 300 people on the tee box. And that whole week I had media, so there was just a lot of buildup. I didn't feel good about my game, so that's even added nerves and pressure. And I get over the first ball, and then I hit the ball, and I don't even remember, like, the whole thing. I don't even remember the whole thing. And then I'm walking down the fairway and I'm like, oh, wow, this is, you know, happening. We're here we go. And so that was definitely one of the most nervous times I've been. Trying to think one other time. I had one where, I'm trying to remember. Okay, so I was leading a tournament going into Sunday at the Honda. I was really nervous driving to the golf course, because I was thinking, I'm like, this is unbelievable. I'm finally in contention. This is my chance to win. And just driving to the course, my mind was racing. And I'm like, man, this is – and I called my mental coach. I called some people. I said, hey, I need some help right now. I'm really nervous. And they actually helped me. I started out really good in the round, and I didn't finish great. But there's just been a few times when I've been really nervous.
Who's your mental coach, and what advice did they give you that morning?
A guy by the name Jay Brunza. He's an older guy that's worked with a lot of guys over the years. And he just – we did some breathing, so he kind of calmed me down in that way. And then we just talked about all other times where I've had leads or been in contention in college, amateur golf, and how successful I've been. And he said, all right, let's focus on how good you did then. And, you know, it's the same thing. Yes, there's more people and there's more money on the line and whatever, but it's the same thing. It's still golf. You still put it in the hole. And so we kind of just talked through some of that and did some positive imagery stuff. And it obviously didn't work out. I didn't win the tournament, but, you know, I at least started well, and so what he helped me with that. So,
do you find that a lot of your colleagues on tour have mental coaches?
Yes, some do. Most people don't really talk about it.
Yeah, what's up with that?
I don't know. I think a lot of guys don't want people to know about them. You know, if they think they have someone that's better than someone else, or they think, hey, man, this guy's kind of my leg up on someone else. I don't think they like to tell people.
Reasonably so, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, because everyone knows who your swing coach is, who your putting coach is, all this stuff. But no one really knows kind of what you do off the golf course.
Right.
So I think a lot of people try to hide that from people.
Who's Wyndham on the phone with? Yeah. Who's he talking to?
Exactly. And if you're playing good, people start asking those questions. They're like,
do they really?
Who's Wyndham working with? What's going on?
You do know? They really?
Oh, yeah.
It's a small world.
It is, yeah.
It's a small tribe. It's not a circus, but it's a small traveling tribe.
It kind of it can be a circus at times.
Do a lot of there's a lot of camaraderie on tour. There's a lot of, like, you know, one of my favorite things to see is, like, an opponent congratulating, you know, the winner or the successor. You know what I mean? Like, and I heard a story we filmed with Tom Watson this summer, and when he beat Jack at the Open, Jack came up to him and said, you know, I gave you my best shot, but you beat me. Mm-hmm. You played better. And that is something that, you know, we'd like to say happens in a lot of sports, but in a lot of sports, it's 12 men or 11 men on the field or five guys on the court.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Golf is one of those rare situations where even tennis, it's like you're actually playing against each other. But in golf, it's kind of like, do you have that feeling like you're just like, I'm playing my own game. I don't want to know the standings right now. I don't want to look at the leaderboard.
Well, it actually used to bug me growing up when I see guys going congratulate another player. I'm like, why is he doing that? Like, that's the guy you're trying to beat. But now that I'm out here, I get why that happens, because we travel so much. It's so hard to win, and you become friends with these guys, and their success doesn't really affect your success. Because in that tournament, if I finished eighth and he finished first, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes in. I mean, there's money and points, and so it really, it's not as much of a competition against guys. It, you know, golf is more of a competition against yourself in the golf course. So I've grown to really like that, and I think that's great. And I hope when I get my first win, I hope I have my buddies out there, and I'll be out there for them. What was your other question?
The other question was, I think there was just a long way of asking one question.
Sorry.
Anyone listening in their car knows what the question was, but we're in the moment here. It's going fast. I'm curious to know, you know, looking at what do you care about the most in your own game right now? Like, what is your thing where you're like, this is, what do you love about your game and what do you not love about your game right now?
Currently, right now, I do not love how I'm putting.
Okay.
It's always been a huge strength for me, and I haven't been putting great. So kind of my putting and short game has just been off. After the fall season, I worked really hard on my ball striking, and that's actually improved quite a bit. But of course, you know, you focus on one thing and you kind of neglect something else and it goes down. So
throughout your entire career, I'm sure that, because that happens for amateurs. I go work on chipping, all of a sudden I cannot putt.
Oh yeah. And that's the most frustrating thing about this game is there's times when I'm putting and chipping unbelievable, but I can't get the ball in play.
Right.
And then there's times when I'm hitting unbelievable and I can't get a putt to fall. So it's a crazy sick game that
someone must have done some research on that. Like, how is that possible? Like, why can't I just do the four things? Why can't I drive? Why can't I hit an iron? And why can't I have a chip and putt? Like, why can't I do all four things?
Believe me, I've been I've been wanting those days. I hope they come in bunches, but I haven't had them yet.
Your best stat is driving distance. Average 306. And that's like, is that always, I'm not really clear on how that stat is measured. Is that, are you hitting three wood some of the time? I mean,
well, you know, actually, so funny you said that. I don't even know because,
yeah,
like, how do they, the people don't always know what you're hitting off the tee, I don't think. Yeah. But I imagine it's got to be a driver because there's no way you could average 306 when you're hitting four irons on some tees and hitting it 230 or 240, you know. So it's got to be driver, but there's times when, I mean, people must miscalculate things.
Do you have different swing thoughts for different shots? Like with driver, do you have a swing thought?
I actually do believe there's two swings in golf. I think there's an iron, kind of iron wedge swing, and I think there's a driver swing.
Okay. So I agree. Because one you're hitting down, one you're hitting up.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of times, like I have an iron feel, and then with driver, I might be thinking about something a little different than what my iron feel is. And I think that's pretty common for a lot of guys. You know, some guys it maybe comes easier and they just have to think about one thing. But for me, I think about two things.
How much, like for the driver, for example, how much does your feel like change? You know what I mean? Like, cause I know for me, pretty much like once every 1 to 2 or 3 months, my feel is totally different. Like I'm like, now I'm looking for this wrist condition. Now I'm looking for my right knee. Now I'm looking for, you know, like keeping those hands forward, you know, like how often do you switch up a feel with the driver swinger, for example?
Yeah, but it changes. I think I'm always working on the same overall look for the swing.
Okay.
So for me, I'm always trying to make sure the club's going outside my hands and then I'm dropping it in the slot and then kind of hitting up on it and releasing it. So that's kind of like the general thing. But 1 week I might be focusing on the takeaway. The next week might be, all right, that takeaway is great. Now we need to focus on dropping the slot. And then now it's like, all right, the backswing, downswing starting to look good, but we're holding on to the face. So now we need to release it, you know?
Right.
So it kind of, and then it's in a cycle. So then it's like, oh, well, now the backswing's off. So then, I mean, it's just this game. I mean, more and more you talk about it, the more and more you go, why do I even play this?
But you should just shut the podcast down.
Yeah.
I will say, though, this week bodes well for you. We're at the beginning of the Waste Management. I don't know when this episode's going to air, but typically, guests of the show, very, very good finish that week.
Well, I've had, it's so funny you say that, I've had so many guys, I've played pro-ams with them, like, hey, the last three guys we played with won the tournament, or they've done this, this, and this, and none of those have ever happened to me, so I really hope this time
you're right,
yeah.
This is a good week. This is your hometown now?
Yeah.
What course are you at here? Where do you practice?
I play at Wisprock.
Oh, cool.
Wisprock, and then I'm a PXG player, so we get to play out at Scottsdale National.
Cool. As well. How do you like Bob? He's a good guy.
Yeah, Bob's a great guy. Yeah. He's been awesome with me, and you know, what he does for our clubs and for the players is spectacular.
That's great. All right, we're going to take a quick break, everybody. Stay tuned. All right, guys, got a read for you from Devereaux. As you know, I travel quite a lot, and I mean a lot. That's italicized, so I really am supposed to emphasize that second one. A lot. I need easy care and comfortable apparel to get me through my long trips. I just started wearing this brand that started in Arizona by two brothers called Devereaux, Devereux. I actually didn't know it started in Arizona, which is pretty cool. I'm excited to meet these guys because I do really dig their clothes. I like wearing them. The fabric, the design, the fit, it's all there. Anyway, these dudes are making apparel for a lifestyle exactly like mine, like yours truly, like your guy Eric. Golf, travel, and kicking back. They design all their products with some type of performance feature. I don't know what it is. I'm going to dig into it at some point. But it adds stretch to each piece, and it keeps me comfortable whether it's on the flight or on the course or at dinner afterwards. I feel kind of like a G rolling in with this Devereaux gear. Anyway, check them out, the Devereaux brothers and their apparel at dvrxthreads.com, and use my name, Eric, E-R-I-K, at checkout to receive 20% off your first order. Again, it's dvrxthreads.com. You can also find them on Insta. Use my name, Eric, E-R-I-K, at checkout to get 20% off your first order. Support the brands that support what we do. I think they're cool. You probably would too. The pants are also rad. Quarter zips, you know, whatever. Just have a nuts at it. 20% off your first order. That's a pretty good deal. I mean, you could save some cash if you spent some. All right, later. All right, I'm going to catch me now. We got give me a second, all right? I'm about to do an ad read for Vice Golf. I don't even have a read, so this is an ad lib. This is an ad libbed read. Anyway, Vice Golf, you all know I love the brand. They make a great golf ball, and there are things that I would tell you in person about the golf ball that I can't tell you in a public forum. But basically, the golf ball is amazing.
technically speaking, on test, it performs as good or better than what we call, quote, the best golf ball on tour. Now, the Vice Golf Ball also has one cool thing, which is that it's cool. Obviously, the scripting is really sweet. But beyond that, it has another cool thing. I'm going to keep pulling cool things out of this ball. The second cool thing is that you can't get it in a pro shop. So go online, go to vicegolf.com, and get your slick balls. They've got all different types. They've got the tour, they've got the drive, they've got the pro, they've got the pro plus. They've got different colors, and you can also personalize less than you can personalize. I don't know what number you can personalize, but you can personalize them, whereas other brands don't let you personalize them except for once a year. So check out vicegolf.com. Get yourself some smooth and cool balls for the course, that is. Anyway, y'all, see you in the showers until the next ad read. Precision Pro, folks. I'm going to do an ad-libbed Precision Pro read. Here's the thing about Precision Pro. They're made by some great guys in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's got great design. And coming out soon, you're going to get a very special colorway of the NX9 Pro with slope. Is that right? That's it. I got a thumbs up in the studio here that's the exact rangefinder. Not only do you get free battery replacement for life, but you get slope and you get laser. I mean, it is a laser. Laser sharp accuracy. And you get, I don't know, you just get to be part of something cool that I'm down with. So Precision Pro is great. Obviously, the family there in Cincinnati makes them good. We did an RGC there. If you haven't seen it, check out the video on the YouTube channel. We gave everybody a rangefinder. But stay tuned. Coming around April, we're going to be releasing a random golf club version of this rangefinder. It is the most beautiful rangefinder I've ever seen on planet Earth. And I, as you know, I haven't traveled any other planets yet. I've done a lot of countries and states and towns, continents, hemispheres. But I've never left the planet. And I was just talking to someone who said that that's on their bucket list. It's not on mine. I don't share that. But on this planet, the Random Golf Club rangefinder will literally blow your mind, but it won't blow your wallet. The rangefinder for everyone, people. Enjoy it. All right, folks. Adidas. Adidas is pushing the boundaries once again in golf footwear. And if you've been counting, I haven't been counting. It's a lot of times. But they're doing it again, so whatever many times it's been, it's at one. So you need to check this out. It's called the Code Chaos, all capitals. The footwear team let me know that this shoe is meant to break down traditional stereotypes and make a statement that there doesn't have to be one look for the sport when it comes to golf footwear. It's athletic and bold from a style standpoint, but this shoe is seriously packed with technology. It's spikeless, but beyond just being tested with guys like DJ and Xander, they did heat map studies. Heat map. That means they know where you are right now. They literally know. And watch, I'm telling you, you're going to get an ad for Adidas footwear in your feed. I'm telling you, and it's not me. I don't know if it's them. It's probably Xander, not DJ. Xander's got an X in his name, so he's a little more sinister. Even though I would probably feel more likely that DJ would really, he could do some damage with the club to my face. So to see how players shift their weight, they use this heat mapping technology to see where they shift their weight, but also where you are physically at this current moment throughout the swing. So anyway, with all that info, they created a new traction system called Twist Grip. Twist Grip. That's spelled the way it sounds. Anyway, so the players get the grip they need exactly where they need it, and this is an ad lib, and when they need it. I just added that. It's waterproof. Waterproof is key. Let's get honest, folks. If you want a waterproof shoe, unless you live in the desert, you can wear sandals or moccasins. But for everybody else, you need the waterproof shoe. So hit up the Code Chaos. It's waterproof, lightweight, and obviously has the boost cushioning, which we all love. There's even a high-top BOA version, which I'm not sure I'm man enough to rock, but John Rahm is. But he's also, he's very, very good at golf. We can all agree. These things are next level, so get yourself a pair. Head over to adidas.com/codechaos. Spelled the way it sounds. Although the CH in chaos sounds more like a K. So it's CODECHAOS. And shop the styles and follow Adidas Golf on Instagram and Twitter for all the latest news from Les Trois Stripes. That's three stripes, folks. All right, one more ad read. I'll probably do another one after this. Jones Sports Go, folks. If you want the bag that I rock, it's the Jones Sports Bag. They got the Player Series. They got the original. What's the other models they got? The stand bags? We're pulling it up in the studio, folks. But here's the thing. Jones If you haven't seen the video on YouTube yet, please check it out. We went up there, visited with them. We designed a lot of cool stuff. We're going to be designing more stuff. We have two bags on the Random Golf Club site that have the Random Golf Club script on it. The Utility Trooper is the info I'm getting of the name of the other bag that I like. It's got the stand. It's got the stand bag. I mostly rock the original, which is based on a design from the 70s. What's his name? Jones? His name was Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones and me. Now, that guy got in a lot of trouble for some, what's that? Taxi cabs. But the guy who sang the song, Mr. Jones, he's gotten a lot of trouble. Don't want to talk about him. But Mr. Jones, not that the song is written about, was a taxi driver in New York. He made a golf bag out of the upholstery in his taxi. And that's where Jones has come from. So they're obviously the comfortable shoulder strap on the original series is what I love. Got a lot of cargo space, and you got three pockets to hold all your clubs. And you look basically like a badass. If you don't have a significant other at the start of the round, you will have one at the end. Am I right? Watch out. It's you know, that's the studio here says, get a Jones bag. I'm not going to say get laid, but basically that's what's going to happen. I mean, I didn't say it. You said it. You heard it. I didn't say it. Jones Sports Co., everybody. Love them. TaylorMade, folks. I got to tell you, the first golf clubs that ever went in my little old hands were TaylorMade Burner Oversize. They had some crusty old grips that I redid myself at risk of my own fingertips with the razor, and I got high because I don't know if you've ever re-gripped your clubs, but you become an inhalant addict. Because you're putting like really noxious stuff. Don't grip your own clubs unless you really want to. Anyway, mad respect. Give me a fist bump whenever I see you. I grip my own clubs. I put the grips on them myself. I say, how much did you say? I mean, you could save money. You save money because I think you put them on. It's like $20 each, and you buy the grips yourself. It's like $8. By the way, regripping 14 clubs. I mean, that's like a lot. Go buy TaylorMade's instead. They come with grips. My favorite TaylorMade edition. Now, obviously, the Sim Max I'm playing is a monster club. One of the many things Tiger Woods have and I in common is playing the Sim. But also, I kind of love the wedges. The raw-faced wedges, MG. I both love the high toe in matte black. I also have a matte black shaft. I know you didn't ask, but I went ahead and told you. Anyway, TaylorMade, my favorite thing about TaylorMade beyond the incredibly performing equipment is the people that make this company up. The band of brothers down here, the band of sisters, the family in Carlsbad really, really gets behind what we do. And that means it's important for you to get behind what they do. So go support TaylorMade, everybody, and hit them straight or just don't. Just hit them with TaylorMade's, though. Just get some. Just stop messing around with all the others. Hit them straight with TaylorMade, but just hit TaylorMade at least. I mean, if you're not. I mean, just go. I mean, what are you doing? Just pause the pod. Go on TaylorMade. What's their website? They don't even need a website. Just go find TaylorMade ASAP. There should be what? What I play? I play the okay. Studio is asking me to play. I play the P760s, 4 through pitch. Then I've got the milled grind raw face 50, 54, and 58. And then I rock. I'm in between the gapper and the Sim Hybrid right now. I play the 2 gapper. I've got a steel shafted 6.5 Project X in that one, as with all the irons. And then on the driver, I have the Sim Max with a 9 degree. I'm still working on getting my numbers on that. I don't really know. I got the 10.5 and the 9. We're going to do a little experimentation. Maybe, honestly, you know what? Whatever one I don't use, how about it's yours? How about that? I don't know how we're going to manage this. Head over to the Instagram account. Get ready for the old giveaway of the driver that I can't hit. Anyway, TaylorMade's the family, folks.
So, grew up in Denver. I've only played golf in Denver twice, or 3 times rather. And I'm curious to know if, like, when you left Denver the first time after experiencing mile high ball flight, were you like, what a grind? The ball's not going anywhere. With the altitude, it's a big difference.
Yeah, well, what's actually even tougher about growing up in altitude is not necessarily the distance. Is more your mishits are exaggerated at sea level. And so in Colorado, you don't spin the ball as much. And so your mishits are actually more online. So it's a weird thing, but
Whoa. When
you're in, like when I play at altitude, I hit the ball, I'll hit off the toe, it goes straight. If I hit off the heel, it goes straight. And then you go to, let's say you're playing at Pebble, and you do that, and the ball goes 40 yards offline. You're like, oh my God, you know, what? I don't understand it. And so that was the hardest thing for me growing up is I thought I was a good ball striker, and then I'd go play in Florida and I'm hitting all over the place. I'm like, what is going on? And so that is kind of something that most people don't maybe either know or talk about, but there's definitely a difference between altitude and sea level.
Yeah, it's that thin air, I guess. Yeah.
It just goes, I don't know what it is. I think the ball spins less and your misses are exaggerated at sea level versus up in altitude.
You grew up there and played golf with some friends of mine, and I actually, Alexandra, and I played with Alexandra and her dad, and I had the best round of the year.
Oh, nice.
And part of me was like, cool it, Eric. Like, you know, her dad plays golf, let it, you know what I mean? But I remember maybe that's why. Maybe I need to just go to Denver to play my best round.
I mean, that's probably why you were hitting it so good.
Like, I couldn't miss. It was crazy.
Yeah.
When you, I just went to the Rose Bowl, and, you know, the Ducks were in it.
Yep.
And I was thinking about you, and I was wondering, what if it was Oregon versus OSU?
Well, I really hope you don't think about me that often.
Well, no, but I mean, in hindsight, having gone to two really competitive schools in all sports, like, who would you root for?
If people ask me this all the time, I love both schools and I root for both schools, and this might make me a front runner, but I went to both schools, so I feel like I can say this, but whoever it means the most for. So if it was a national championship, I'd be really torn. I'd have no idea. Ooh. But if it was you know, the ninth game of the year and they're playing, and let's say OSU's ranked number one and Oregon's already lost twice or vice versa, then I'd root for the team that it means more for.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that's kind of my answer.
That's a really good answer.
Yeah.
Have you gone to a bowl game? What's your favorite sport outside of golf?
Actually, hockey.
Hockey?
Yeah. Hockey's my favorite.
Do either of those schools have hockey teams?
No. No, they do not.
But, okay, have you been to a bowl game?
I have. Yeah, I went to a BCS bowl game when Oklahoma State played Missouri, and it was at Jerry's World in Dallas.
Okay, so you were rooting. You were.
I was at Oklahoma State at the time.
Right.
So I went, yeah.
So maybe you don't have the same experience that I had, because when we went to the Rose Bowl, like, I have a lot of business friends and golf friends in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So good reason to root for the Ducks.
Of course, yeah.
My parents met at the University of Wisconsin, and I have other friends who live in Wisconsin. So it was a real tear for me. I didn't really know which side to root for. And the irony was, the overall experience was like, wow, this stadium is filled 50-50
with fans.
Yeah, whereas, like, I'm used to going to, like, a Dodger game. Yeah. And it's like, all right, 95% Dodger fans, let's go Dodgers.
Yep.
So it was very strange to me to have it be, like, down the middle. And I guess, you know, my experience actually was, we were sitting in the Duck section, and maybe it was a particularly obnoxious area.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was aggressive.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess that's just a part of college football that you don't quite see in, you know, baseball or NFL or...
Well, you got a great game to go to being a torn fan, because it came down to last play and it was a 1-point victory, so...
Yeah, and it was such a wild and close game.
Yeah, it was. It was a great game.
So when you... What is it like to switch halfway through? It's not an experience that most professional athletes have in their amateur history.
Yeah. I never thought when I was 16, 17, 18, kind of in the recruiting process, and then I end up choosing Oklahoma State, I never thought I'm going to go to another school. I had everything orange. I bled orange. I mean, that's kind of their thing there. And I still love the Pokes, and I still love OSU. But, you know, some things happened in my life, and a lot of changes kind of happened. We had a coaching change. Just a bunch of different things, and I just felt like I needed a change. I needed a fresh start, and it was really probably the best decision I've ever made in my life, because I went from kind of – I was down in my game, transferred to Oregon, and then I had the best year of my career. As an amateur, it was the best year, and, you know, that helped me get out here. It got me some sponsorships, got me PXG, and so it was definitely a positive experience, but it was also a very tough one. There was a lot of things – you know, behind closed doors and with family members where it wasn't easy. I mean, I was down. There's times when I didn't know where I was going to go, what I was going to do. And I'm just blessed that it ended up working out as good as it did.
Well, like what? Like, I mean, I'm trying to guess. So I'm thinking, like, is it like difficulty with, like, you know, changing schools as a kid, and it's like hard to, like, navigate the social environment?
No, well, you don't even know. You have to get a full release from your coach to be able to transfer. And you know, for a little while, I didn't know if I was going to get a release. So then I'm stuck on the team, and you can't, then you obviously, he knows you don't want to be there anymore. And so then he's like, he's not going to play you.
Right.
So there's that issue. So then I'm like, well, I'm not going to play my senior year. And then when you get the release, then it's like, all right, well, now where do I go and what's the best opportunity? It wasn't like I said, hey, I want to transfer and I want to go play for Oregon right away. I went then on another like recruiting process to find which school was best for me. And then the stresses of, all right, well, I'm a fifth year. I want to graduate. I want to be able to play right away. I don't want to have to sit out because, you know, I don't want, I'm already in school for 5 years. I don't want to play anymore. And then, you know, then the struggle of you transfer to a new team and I'm a guy coming in and I have to meet all new people. I don't know anyone. There's just a lot of things. So I felt like a freshman again.
Yeah.
Yet I already been in school for 4 years. So it was a weird dynamic.
What did you like learn from that? What did you take away?
I learned a lot about myself, and I also learned to enjoy the game more. I was really down in a rut for about 2 years and I didn't like golf. I hated it. I contemplated quitting multiple times. And then when I transferred to Oregon, Casey Martin and now my caddy, but my assistant coach at the time, John Ellis, they really helped make golf fun again. And they improved my game. They had a really good plan for me. They set it up exactly how I thought was the best. Well, what they thought was best, but what I also thought was best for me to succeed at the next level and that year. And so it was a very easy transition. And I really learned to love the game and I gained a lot of confidence that year.
When you say made it fun again, I mean, I'm like, was that just because they were helping your performance or was there something else?
Well, golf is always fun when you're playing well, but
agreed.
But yeah, exactly. I mean, when you're shooting well, golf is fun, but
no matter how good or bad you are.
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing.
Exactly. But if you can still have fun with the game when you're not playing well, then that you truly love the game and you are enjoying the game. I was getting to where I would shoot even par one under, which isn't necessarily terrible. And I was pissed off and didn't even want to go practice. So I'm like, I don't even want to touch a club right now. And that's how it was for a few years. And then I got to where, you know, I just wanted to go practice. I wanted to get better. I wanted to work on my game. I wanted to do these things in golf and I'd have bad days and it would motivate me to play better the next time rather than, you know, demotivate me and make me feel like I don't even want to play anymore. And so it transitioned and they helped make it fun.
Was it something they said or what was it that clicked?
Well, Casey, yeah. I mean, Casey definitely mentored me a lot. He helped me with, he introduced me to my current sports psychologist, which helped. And then they just were very positive influences. And so they just kept feeding me how good I was and kept telling me how good I'm going to be and how good of a year I'm going to have. And just all the positivity, I started to believe that again. And, then I went out and played money games against John and Casey, and they are great players. And, you know, I'd beat them in times and they'd beat me, and it made it very fun and competitive. And,
they were friendly.
It was very friendly. It was obviously friendly. But I started gaining confidence in that. I'm like, hey, I mean, Casey played on tour. He played with Tiger, and John just came off the web tour. I'm like, I'm beating these guys, and I'm beating everyone on my team. And I'm like, all right, I still got this. Like, I'm still really good. And so it just gave me a lot of confidence. And as that started building, I started playing better and better and better. And then it led to, you know, where I am now.
It's funny, right before you said I would come off the course shooting par or one under, I was actually wondering if 18 pars would be aggravating.
Yeah.
It's awful.
It is, which is crazy. I mean, that's what's crazy about golf is you could be a guy that shoots 120 and, you know, just shooting one. I mean, you shoot 100 and it's great, but you have different ideals of what good is. And so for me, 18 pars would be like, all right, well, either I'm not putting well or I'm not hitting it close to the hole, and you start getting frustrated. And
what's your lowest round ever in or out of a tournament?
I've shot 60 a few times.
Wow.
I've never 59.
But 60 is like, are you lit up? Are you on fire? Are you like, don't talk to me? Are you just like, what's happening?
Well, unfortunately, I've never done it in a tournament. I want to do it in a tournament.
Is it? Well, so where did you do it? I mean, you've done it multiple times.
Yeah.
Multiple times.
The first time is the first time, I don't even know if I should say this, but the first time I ever did it, it was the first time I ever drank on a golf course.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And
is that allowed on tour? No, it's not really allowed on tour. No. But John Daly does it.
Well, it's just funny you say that. I had John Daly's on the golf course when I shot my first 60. So it was in like just a fun little member guest. And we're playing from the men's tees, not the tips. So I guess it doesn't count 100%. But, you know, I turned, I think, at 4 or 5 under. And then next thing you know, I'm 11 under. And I have 2 holes to go. And the guys in the group are all like, they're kind of getting quiet and weird. And I had no idea. I've been drinking. We're having fun, listening to music. And I missed a putt from like 12 feet. And they all started going, oh, no. You know, like they're starting to react different than what they were. I mean, they were rooting almost against me because we're playing for money.
Right.
So now they're rooting for me. And, you know, I start hearing them talking. And I go, am I like, you know, I didn't really know. And one of the guys goes, hey, you're like 11 or 12 under or something, aren't you? And I go, well, I've made a lot of birdies. I haven't really been counting. And so on the last hole, I ended up birding the last hole, but I didn't shoot 59. So that was the first time. And then other times it's they've kind of been the same. I'm having fun with my friends and I don't really know it. And the next thing you know, I have 3 holes to go and I'm like, dang, I'm 10 under. I could shoot 59.
So your caddy's name is John?
John, yeah.
So do you try to, like, do you and John try to emulate that environment on the course? Or, I mean, the problem with the tournament is there's a lot of business.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work to do. Mm. There's a lot of navigating. You got to get there early. You got to walk in. You got to get to the first tee. It's like a lot of like, it's not the same. Is there a way to emulate it though?
Well, that's what we try to do. And John does a great job with that. I mean, he constantly is, you know, talking trash to me, making fun of me or making fun of other things. So we're laughing. We're trying to keep it the same. But it is tough. It's, I mean, at the same time, it's a little more, it's heightened. There's not music blaring. You're not having a couple beers. So it is different, but we try to do that because that's when I'm loose, and I think most players are this way. If you're loose and kind of not really caring, you usually play your best.
Yeah. It is the ultimate, like, teaching of golf is the more you care, the worse you will hit the ball.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Whether it's a long shot, a short shot, or whatever. Yeah, but there's no way to extricate the two. I don't know how.
Yeah, it's – I mean, if you find out if there's a special way, because there's times when golf seems easy and you don't really have a care, and that's when I've played great. And then there's times when I start pressing and trying, and then that's when things go even worse.
Yeah.
So
Troy Mullins, you know, the long drive champion, mm-hmm. said that the time that she won was when she was looking at the scoreboard, and it was she was disappointed because it wasn't as far as she thought it should be, the yardage of the long drive. And she was actually looking at the wrong board, and it was showing someone else's performance.
Oh, really?
So she was just swinging freely, and I just thought about that from like a regular, you know, round of 18 perspective, and it's like, I mean, I don't know. It would just be great if it just was – if you had that ability to just turn that off.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure everyone would be better.
Yeah, we would all be looking for that. So in the realms of the PGA Tour world – you kind of came into this crazy experience that I can't even imagine what it was like to be a part of. Where, who were you paired with at this tournament? Where the disqualification?
I was playing with Lucas Beauregard and Denny McCarthy.
So basically what happens is, and for those of you that are listening, if you don't know how this works, during a tournament, you don't keep your own score. You keep Lucas's score, for example. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to ask usually, right? At the end of a hole, you just know where they're at.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if they got into some crazy trouble, you would be like, what was that?
Yeah, and or you write it down, and then in the tent, you know, you write a 6, and then you get in, he's like, oh, hey, I actually had a 7 on the hole, or I had a 5, and you, okay, and then you change it.
Right. And so when you came into the tent, you signed a scorecard where they were supposed to give you a bogey, but they gave you a par.
Yeah.
And somehow didn't notice it, and then you get disqualified.
Yeah, it's 100% of my fault. It has nothing. I think actually I don't even know who was keeping my card, so it's not even on them. It's 100% on you.
You sign it.
You can keep your score at the top of a scorecard,
knowing
exactly what you have. And I knew I made bogey on that hole. What really happened is I was doing fine in the tournament, and I missed a short putt on the second hole for birdie, and then proceeded to make like three or four bogeys in a row. And so I was, and then coming in, I made a bogey as well. So I was just heated. I went from being all right to then just completely out of the tournament. Essentially, I shot like six or seven over. And I was just so mad that I walked in, I quick signed the card. I didn't even look.
Right.
And so it's not on him. And I mean, he saw me get up and down on the hole and he thought it was for par, but he forgot that I had to chip out. And so that's what happened. And so, I mean, I joke, or people joke with me calling me a cheater and stuff. And I'm like, hey, I mean, I cheated. Yeah. But I wasn't trying to. And it happened. I think everyone on tour's probably done it once.
Right.
And once you do it, you never do it again. So
yeah, you will never make that mistake.
No.
Again.
So, I mean, and people were blaming my caddy, and to his credit, he didn't even have time to get into the scoring tent.
Right.
I signed it so fast and said, you know, screw this. There's no way we messed it up. We have a score. He was keeping my score, whatever. And, it happened.
You know, if you don't want to talk about it, no problem. But it makes me think about something that's been on people's minds for a while now. I was at the President's Cup. Everybody was talking about Patrick Reed, how he swiped the sand with the back of his wedge. And, you know, he gets a lot of attention for whatever reason. I don't know. It seems like he's always on the wrong side of an argument. I like Patrick. He's done very nice things for me when he didn't have to. And ultimately, that's how I judge somebody. His character to me is when you're nice to someone that you don't have to be nice to.
Mm-hmm.
Simple. And I've seen a lot of people on tour who have not been nice to me. And I'm kind of like, okay, like, I get it. You're working. I don't want to make anybody's life harder. But then I've seen a lot of people who have been nice to me when they didn't have to. And that means a lot. And I think that no matter what your position is in the world, feeling seen as a part of this golf world is important. Patrick did that to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always going to kind of look at that as my own personal experience with him. The thing that made me feel weird is that everyone's going crazy about him cheating, but Phil did it at a major. And I don't know, maybe you can't talk about it because it's just your world, and I would totally understand if you're like, no comment.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to me, and I don't like to talk about this stuff. I don't like to talk about politics. I don't like to talk about religion. Anything that's going to create a divisive, you know, discussion is not really what I'm interested in having. But from your perspective, from your own story, what I'm hearing is like, you know, it happens a lot, and it's kind of like knowing the rules is key. Now, I don't know. Should we get into a debate? Do you want to comment on it or not really?
Well, as far as...
It feels your face is telling me you kind of don't want to comment.
Well, yeah. I mean, as far... I don't really want to throw anyone under the bus, but in my instance, I think... I mean, obviously, I did something wrong. I didn't intentionally do it.
Right.
The best thing, I think, in those circumstances is just to own up to it.
Right.
I think when people make mistakes in life. If you deliberately cheated or accidentally cheated, because there's times when you accidentally cheat and you didn't even know the rule.
Right.
And then there's times when you do it. But if you just own up to it, I think people accept that and are okay with it. And, you know, in my instance, I just told people, I said, yeah, I screwed up. I wasn't deliberately trying to cheat. I mean, if I was in contention, maybe you could argue that, but I was so far out of contention that, you know, me shaving off one score really didn't mean anything.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. I think it's at the end of the day, you have to live with it. And, you know, if you can live with it, then that's you. I think I would struggle living with, if I purposely shaved off a score and got away with it, I think that would really bother me. So, you know, I just think it all comes down to each, it's individual.
Yeah. Do you think, sticking on the rules for a second, do you think that, you know, one of the topics in the rules discussion is distance and course sustainability for professional golf. Do you see that as an issue at all?
I don't. I don't really know, because I just think, I mean, I think they let the cat out of the bag a long time ago, and you can't now tone back the ball or tone back the drivers or tone, I mean, it's already there. Like, you've already... Everyone's exposed to it, so you can't do that.
It would be so weird
if all of
a sudden you were driving at 270.
Yes, and that's not even fun for, I think, the spectators. The spectators want to see us hit at 330,
yeah.
and they're amazed by that. If we start hitting it only 260, they're like, oh, well, you know, that's kind of what everyone does if there's a limit on the ball, as far as the ball standpoint.
Sure.
You know, I think our conditions are tough. I really think if I'm a spectator, I want to see birdies. I want to see the best players in the world do the best things in the world. when they're making pars, bogeys, or doubles, it's kind of like, well, these guys aren't that good, you know, and that's, and, you know, so I'm kind of on the new age of things where I think, you know, I think the better we get, the more fun and exciting the product's going to be.
Yeah. I heard Riv, they roll the fairways.
Yeah. Well, some of the, that's the other thing that's skewed is some of the, like when you play TPC, for instance, if you play this any other time other than this tournament, your ball hits and maybe rolls no more than 5-10 yards.
Yeah.
Okay. And so out here, I'd be flying it probably 300, 305, and then go to 310. Come tournament week and it's rock hard firm, I'm hitting it, flying at 305, same thing, but it's rolling to 360. So like the course is set up for us to hit it even farther. So right. It's not always the golf ball and the equipment. I mean, they made, like you said, they roll the fairways so they're even faster. So we're hitting it 360, 370, 380, and they're just like, oh my God, the ball's going too far. Well, right. They're setting that up.
It's getting that hard bounce.
Yep.
Well, and also, you know, on some level, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but it seems like the swing is changing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems like when I see, you know, Hovland, Neiman, you know, Morikawa, I feel like I see a lot of the same swing. I feel like I see it coming outside. I see a little bowed wrist.
Yep.
And I just see them turn through it with, like, insane speed.
Yep.
And it's just a draw that just stays, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No one's really hitting a cut, except for DJ.
And me.
And you. But, I mean, you know what I mean? Like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
I'm talking, you know, like you're 26.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm like 19. It seems like every kid's swing is identical.
Yeah. Well, and that could be, I haven't really paid attention to it, but I do know that now, just like in baseball, the whole thing is hitting home runs. It used to be about contact and batting over 300 and getting on base. And now it's about how many home runs you can hit. It's kind of gone that way in golf where if you can hit it over 300 in the air, like that's a huge advantage.
Yeah.
Which I agree, and maybe I've always had distance, so I somewhat agree, but I also think there's so much more to golf. I mean, when it comes down to it, I think you putt for dough. The drive is for show, and it does help, and I think it sets you up. But, I mean, Tiger didn't win all of his majors and tournaments by driving 300 yards. He made it because he already won those because he was making putts.
You what's your club head speed?
Well, on average, I'm like a 121, 122 guy.
Because with a cut, to be carrying 300, you've got to have a big number there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't swing that fast. I mean, there's times maybe when I get up to 125, but...
You just said I don't swing that fast. Just want 121 miles an hour.
Yeah, but checking. I mean, guys like... I mean, there's guys out there I think that swing a lot faster. I think I've been... I don't know. I think my smash factor's kind of high, and so
5.0, 5.1.
Yeah, I think I max out of what I put in.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of guys. I mean, there's times everyone does this. If you swing as hard as you can, a lot of times you miss the face.
Sure.
So yeah, you swung 130, yeah. But it only flew, you know, 295. Versus if you hit it center of the face at 121 and it flies 310.
Right.
You know,
accuracy and precision.
Yeah.
Why do you play a cut?
It's just what I naturally play.
Always been a cut.
I wish I could draw the ball
really
a lot more, but yeah.
So if you walked up to, you know, a hole like two at Augusta, are you thinking I need to draw this ball? Or are you just like, no, just cut it. Just cut it, land it right on that bunker there.
Yeah, so I've gotten better at drawing a driver. Realistically, I've always thought about this. At Augusta, I would have a strong three wood. So it's easier to draw three wood. And I'd have that thing gooped up to where I could just hit a sling and draw, and that's what I would hit. Everyone would be like, man, he hits 3-wood, 295. Well, it's more like a 2-wood.
Yeah, it's like a spoon. Remember the spoons?
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, that's crazy to me. Yeah. It's crazy to me to hear that you just said to me, I've been trying to get better at drawing the ball. Is that because just stats tell you, experience tells you, like, get the one shot. Just leave the left side out of play and just always play the cut.
Yeah. Well, definitely, I think off the tee, I think that's the best way to play. I mean, you look at Rory, he's probably one of the best drivers in golf, and he predominantly hits a draw.
Yeah.
And he almost does it, like, all the time.
He can't, with a wedge even.
He draws a lot, and I think there's a lot to having a one shot, but there's times and courses or wins where being able to at least hit, even if it only drew 2 yards, it stays straighter and it holds its line, or you can access left pins, whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I was talking with Brandel Chambly last week, and he was saying that the cut is the shot. Because then, you know, it's not going to go as far. It's going to check up. And as a right-handed player, you kind of always want to end up short right of every pin.
Yeah.
And I was, like, mind blown. I mean, he had these yellow pieces of paper all over the table. It was like he had some stats for, like, how a nuclear reactor worked.
Yeah.
And I believed him for the first time. I really think I understood, oh, why is a cut actually better? Because at some point, for me as an amateur, like, I can swing it pretty hard. I can get the ball out there pretty far. Sacrifice maybe 5-10% on every club with the cut, but gain like accuracy and things like that. Is that, I guess I've understood why you play the cut, but why physically do you think you play the cut? What is it about your swing and your body that? Yeah.
Well, I, for the longest time, I played so many other sports, and I was kind of, I had a homegrown swing growing up. I didn't have a coach until later in high school. And my move was I kind of sucked it in, and then I shifted out, and the club was over the plane a little bit. And so my natural thing was to then swing left to try to square the face.
Yeah.
Well, that created a left path, which created a cut.
But we're talking a degree.
Yeah, a few degrees. So, like, I didn't cut it a huge, but I definitely had a cut swing. Everyone looked at my swing and go, man, that's a cut swing. but, you know, as – that's hard to get rid of. I mean, after
it really is.
Yeah, I mean, if you've done something for, even at a young age, if you do something for 6 years, it doesn't take, you know, it's not like 2 weeks and you've got it figured out. I mean, it takes a long time. Well, I've done that for 15 years or 16 right. years, and so for me to try to make that better and make a tighter cut and be able to hit both ways has been tough for me.
A big part of your life, and kind of, I think to some extent, you know, parts of your career at least and parts of growing up have been the story that is probably difficult to talk about with your mom. And, you know, because of your friendship with Alex, I'd heard about it. And, you know, I think that I don't quite know how to ask you the question or even really what the question is, but I know that, you know, we are here. It's a couple days after Kobe Bryant passed away before his time. And, you know, I know that my mother had come through with cancer, and it's been a few years now. She's been okay. But there is some part of, you know, all of our stories, whether whatever we end up doing for a job or for or to create meaning on, like, this planet for the life we have. You know, you had a difficult story. Can you tell me how old you were when your mom passed away?
Yeah. So it was 2013 when she passed. I just turned 20. And yeah, I mean, my mom was also a breast cancer survivor. She was like a 14 or 15 year survivor. And then it came back, and it came back very fast, and it was swift. It was, we found out, and 6 months later she passed. So it was definitely tough. I mean, when anyone passes, doesn't matter what the age is, it's tough. But, you know, my mom was just in her early 50s and still really young. My sister and brother, we were young. And yeah, it was definitely the toughest thing I've ever had to go through in my life. And you know, I don't go very often without thinking about my mom. And
every day.
Yeah, you know, the first 5 years, it was definitely every day. I mean, any little thing, if you said the color pink, my mom worked for Mary Kay, pink would strike that, and I'd think about my mom. Or if you said something, or if I went and had Italian and they had something that she used to cook all the time, I'd think about my mom. So it was very, it was hard because I couldn't get away from it. As I've grieved and gotten over it, I don't think about it as much, but I definitely don't go more than 2 days. So she, now that I play golf, I think about a lot, or as a living, for a living, cause she wanted me to do that and to trust, you know, and trust what I wanted to do and go for my dreams. And, you know, so when I go out there and play, there's a lot of times when I'm having success, that I think about her and wish I could hug her after I play, or have her here to see this because she was always there when I was younger, or when things are not going well, and I just, you know, I just want my mom there, you know. And so those are the times where I really think about her, and it's tough. But you know, there's a lot of positives that came out of, which is hard to say, but there's a lot of positive things that have come out of my mom passing, and there's a lot of people I was able to witness to and tell my story about my mom, and it helped them. Or you know, it's just, it's given me a better perspective. Selfishly, it's helped me as a person grow. It helped our family come together. You know, there's just countless stories where I've talked to kids where their parents were sick, or even adults that were asking me, they're like, man, I've never had to deal with this. What did you do? What was it like? And, you know, it's really humbling to have grown men in their 30s, 40s, and 50s come to a 20-year-old or whatever and ask, you know, like, what helped you? And there really is nothing easy to say, and there's nothing, no magic pill. It's hard. But yeah, my mom's passing has definitely shaped my life, and you know, I definitely wish she was here to witness a lot of my success and my downfalls, whatever it is. I just, you know, I wish she was here.
What was her name?
Lisa.
And did she have like did she have a thing that she would say, like?
Yeah. So my mom was so cute. So she, when I was really little, and it was embarrassing at the time, I would open up my lunchbox, and she'd like have this little note with like some cute little thing written on there, and then she'd say some embarrassing thing. So I'd open it, and my friends would be like, "Oh, you know," they'd make fun of me. Well, that didn't stop in grade school. It went on to high school. I'd find something in my binder, and it'd be some cute thing for my mom. And then it didn't stop when I got to college.
Like, what kind of embarrassing thing? Like,
well, no, just stuff when you're a young boy. You don't want, you know, your mom's lips and say, "Love you, mommy."
Oh, like, yeah, love you, sweetheart.
Yes. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Oh, you're the cutest. You're
not whatever. Like trying to embarrass you.
No,
but
never trying to embarrass me. But like, when you're around with your boys and this little note comes out with whatever, I mean.
Mama's boy.
Yeah, mama's boy. Yeah, exactly.
That's before becoming mama's boy is cool.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and then as it got cooler, I mean, I didn't mind it.
Right.
But one thing my mom always did that is still really special and dear to me, every time before I played any tournament, she'd send me a Bible verse. She'd send me how much she loves me. Go out there, have fun. And then, you know, she'd always, you know, say some little things. And it was every time before I played. And so that's something I really do miss, because there was times when it would be paragraphs long, and I'm like, I really don't want to read this.
I'm tired.
Right now. Yeah. But then, you know, but I would give anything to read those right now. So she, and then her main phrase, and it's something that I've really stuck with me, is she always wanted me to play big. And she meant by that was just play for something bigger than yourself. Don't get caught up in, you know, your selfish ambitions. There's people out there that you can witness and be, you know, you have a platform to help people. And, you know, my dream is to be the best I can be in golf, not just for, you know, my selfish reasons, but also to then give back and help so many people, and help people with cancer, help kids, help people less fortunate than me. And that's kind of how my mom raised me. And that's really kind of, you know, a testament to how she raised me. Yeah.
I'm assuming that she was involved in the decision for you to go to a Christian school as a kid.
Yeah.
Has that been something that you've continued with into your adult life?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very important to me. And it's something that when my mom was getting close to passing, she just, you know, she urged me. And I mean, when you're on your deathbed and you are telling people wisdom and not worrying so much about your selfish needs, it's pretty amazing. You listen. And my mom was, you know, 51, and, you know, she lived way longer than me, and she lived a great life. And, you know, her funeral, she had thousands of people there. And I like to think about it. You know, I hope one day that I have people there that I touched, and my mom touched so many women in Mary Kay, and you know, and that's something that is important to me. And, you know, I hope that one day I can look back and people will say, man, that guy really made a difference in the world.
Have you found a community on tour with the, you know, Larry Moody and the, kind of the, there's, I don't even really know how to say it, but there's weekly sort of church gatherings.
Yeah, Bible studies. Yeah,
Bible study.
There's a College Golf Fellowship.
Tom Randall.
Yeah. So I meet with a guy named Pete Hiskey, who was instrumental, his dad, in starting College Golf Fellowship, which is a college thing, but it's a ministry on tour as well. So there's typically Tuesdays or Wednesdays, there's a Bible study, and it's just great because you go and you meet with other guys on tour, and that's kind of where that camaraderie comes from, because you're doing life together with these guys rather than just competing, playing golf and trying to beat each other. You're also learning about the things they're struggling with. You know, maybe their mom or their wife or something is going through something, and you're just there for them. And it's you know, the tour really has a good community of great people.
This is something that I was lucky enough to experience on the Champions Tour. Tom Randall, who's a caddy and a pastor, invited me, and he said, you know, I'd love you to come, no cameras. And, you know, so without asking you to sort of, you know, I'll tell you what I experienced and see if it's similar. I mean, I went in and I really didn't know what to expect, but it was like Bernard Langer, Tom Kite, just a ton of legends of the game. Yep. All in a sort of an annex room of the hotel, nothing fancy.
Yep.
You know, coffee and cookies, little microphone, little music, some readings, and it ended with perhaps one of the most beautiful golf quotes I've ever heard, which is Tom ending it all out, and we're all kind of holding hands, and he says, you know, competitors.
Yeah.
And he says, "May you may the wind always be at your back, and may you play with the joy that you had as a child."
Yeah.
And I was like, no way is this a professional sport. No way are these people playing against each other. And you know, maybe there's a different vibe on the Champions Tour as far as the camaraderie and the support and the friendship. I would like to believe not, though. I would like to believe that even on the PGA Tour, the most aggressive sort of arena for golf, that would also be like a grounding space for friends.
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's obviously not a huge amount of guys. You know, it's not like there's 100 guys at these studies, but you know, there's times when there's 10 to 20, and you know, you could be paired with them on Sunday, and it really,
that's crazy.
And what's cool about it is, I mean, you're not rooting for them, because obviously you want to win, because a win changes your life and it's our livelihood. But at the same time, there's just not that headbutting. Like, it's not, you know, you're not trying to, you don't want to see that. You want to see that guy succeed, and you want to succeed. And if you end up succeeding more than him, that's great.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you're both going to shake each other's hand, hug, and say, "Hey, man, that was fun. You know, great job. It was fun to play with you." I mean, it's that's what's neat about golf, is there's just such great camaraderie, and it's a gentleman's sport.
Bernard said also, when I interviewed him later, I said, "So what is it like playing golf as a Christian or whatever? You know, how does that change?" And he said, "Well, you know, for a long time in my life, I wasn't Christian. I had no connection to God. And golf became a lot easier when I stopped playing for Bernard Langer and I started playing for something else, someone else."
Yeah.
And that struck me too. And not a Christian myself, it did make me consider converting because, you know, I mean, I'm sort of joking, but.
No, I mean, there's, it. I think in all of history, you look at like when the Red Sox won the World Series after the Boston Marathon. I mean, they truly, I think, played for something bigger than themselves. They played for their city. And I think, not to say that you use something to try to play better in golf, but I just think in anything in life, if you do it for something greater than yourself, I think you perform better. But you also get more enjoyment from it, because I think there's a lot of guys that have had testimonials where they won a tournament or won a championship, they won a team championship, and then they're like, "This is it. I've worked my whole life to do this," and it doesn't quite feel that great.
Right.
And I think when you do it for something, regardless what it is, if it's for someone else or for a purpose or for something greater than you, then I think you get more enjoyment out of it, because it's not just for yourself.
Well, it's been a profound and fun experience to talk to you, getting to know you, and I'm looking forward to watching you play big, and, you know, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry I got a little sentimental at the end, but...
No, it's good.
You know, that's what happens. I mean, my mom's story is very very touching and close to me, and that's part of her story, so I always feel like I have to share that.
You got me. I mean, I was like, don't cry, Eric. It's not even your mom. You know, you don't deserve to cry over his mom.
Yeah.
But, no, I appreciate it. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, we all go through life, and I think, I don't know what happens, but I'm a pretty sensitive guy, but I get like plaque on me. And you know, you just get tough and you're like, ah, that person's annoying. This guy's annoying. Why isn't he doing what I told him to do? Da, 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 like, what do you mean my room's not ready?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's just like,
well, of course. Yeah.
Well, why am I in a middle seat? Like, why can't I get one kid? I mean, it's just, and it's very hard to, especially when, you know, the world is a competitive place, whether in your position, you're, you know, trying to be the best. And I'm just trying to grow this little golf channel thing. You know, it's hard to just like step back and be like, what's actually important to me?
Yeah.
Like, because ultimately that results in kind of letting the gas off of this like incredible drive.
Yep.
Because you have to basically sit there and be like, why am I even here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were supposed to end the podcast 3 minutes ago, but you made it keep going.
Yeah, I'm sorry. My bad.
Any questions for me?
No, I don't think so.
All right. I got off easy on this one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to sharing this episode with everybody.
Yep. Thank you.